This program is copyright 1995 by National Vanguard Books. Post Office Box 330, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946. All rights reserved.
His were the motivations of a libertarian, the sort of self-centered individual who sees the basic evil in government as a limitation on free enterprise. Someone asked him whether he had forgotten what the organization has repeated over and over, namely, that our struggle is to secure the future of our race, and that the issue of individual freedom is subordinate to that one overwhelming purpose. His retort was that the organization's violent tactics are benefiting neither our race nor individual freedom. This answer proved again that he didn't really understand what we are trying to do. His initial approval of the use of force against the system was based on the naive assumption that, by God, we'll show those bastards, when the system, instead of backing down, began tightening the screws even faster, he decided that our policy of terrorism is counterproductive. He simply could not accept the fact that the path to our goal cannot be a retracing of our course to some earlier stage in our history, but must instead be an overcoming of the present and a forging ahead into the future, with us choosing the direction instead of the system. Until we have torn the rudder out of its grasp and thrown the system overboard, the ship of state will go careening on its hazardous way. There will be no stopping, no going back. Since we are already among rocks and shoals, we are bound to get scraped up pretty badly before we find any clear sailing. Maybe he was right that our tactics are wrong. The reaction of the people will eventually answer that question. But his whole attitude, his whole orientation, was wrong. As I listened to Powell, I was reminded of the late 19th century writer, Brooks Adams, and his division of the human race into two classes, spiritual man and economic man. Powell was the epitome of economic man. Ideologies, ultimate purposes, the fundamental contradiction between the system's worldview and ours, all these things had no meaning for him. He regarded the organization's philosophy as just so much ideological flypaper designed to catch recruits for us. He saw our struggle against the system as a contest for power and nothing more. If we could not whip them, then we should try to force them to compromise with us. I wondered how many others in the organization thought the way Powell did, and I shuddered. We have been forced to grow too quickly. There has not been sufficient time to develop in all our people the essentially religious attitude toward our purpose and our doctrines, which would have prevented the Powell incident by screening him out early. As it was, we had no real choice in deciding Powell's fate. There was not only his disobedience to consider, but also the fact that he had revealed himself to be fundamentally unreliable. To have one of us, and a unit leader at that, talking openly to other members about trying to find a way to compromise with the system, with the war just beginning, there was only one way to deal with such a situation. The 8 male members present drew straws, and 3 of us, including me, ended up on the execution squad. When Powell realized that he was going to be killed, he tried to make a break. We tied his hands and feet, and then we had to gag him when he began shouting. We drove him to a wooded area off the highway about 10 miles south of Washington, shot him, and buried him. I got back a little after midnight, but I still haven't been able to get to sleep. I am very, very depressed. The next entry is dated November 4th, 1991. Soup and bread again tonight, and not much of that. Our money is almost gone, and there still hasn't been anything from Washington Field Command. If our pay doesn't come through in the next couple of days, we'll have to resort to armed robbery again, an unpleasant prospect. Unit 2 still has what seems to be an unlimited supply of food, and we'd already be in a much worse way if they hadn't given us that carload of canned goods a month ago. especially since we now have 7 mouths to feed. But it's just too dangerous to drive up to Maryland for our food supply. The chances are too great of running into a police roadblock. That is the most noticeable, and to the public it must be by far the most irritating, consequence to date of our terror campaign. Travel by private automobile has become, at least in the Washington area, a nightmare, with enormous traffic jams everywhere caused by the police checks. In the last few days, this police activity has increased significantly, and it looks as if it will remain a regular feature of life for the foreseeable future. So far, however, they haven't been stopping pedestrians, bicyclists, or buses. We can still get around, although less conveniently than before. Oops, there go the lights again. This is the second time this evening we've had to break out the candles. Until this year, the worst power shortages have occurred in the summer, but it's November now, and we're still stuck with the temporary 15% voltage reduction they imposed in July. Even this perpetual brownout isn't saving us from an increasing number of involuntary blackouts. It's obvious that somebody's profiting from the power shortage, though. When Catherine was lucky enough to find some candles at one of the grocery stores last week, she had to pay $1.50 apiece for them. The price of kerosene and gasoline lanterns has gone out of sight, but the hardware stores never have any of them in stock anyway. When I next have some free time, I'll see what can be improvised in that direction. We have been maintaining the pressure against the system during the past week with a lot of one-man, low-risk activities. There have been approximately 40 grenade attacks against federal buildings and media facilities in Washington, for example, and our unit is responsible for 11 of them. Since it is now virtually impossible to enter any federal building except a post office without a complete body search, we've had to be ingenious. On one occasion, Henry simply pulled the pin on a fragmentation grenade and then slipped it down between two cartons on a big pallet of freight waiting outside the freight door of the Washington Post, wedging it so that the safety lever was held in place by the cartons. He didn't wait around, but news reports later confirmed that there was an explosion inside the Post building, which killed one employee and seriously wounded 3 others. Most often, however, we have used grenade throwers improvised from shotguns. They give us a maximum range of more than 150 yards, but the grenade always explodes sooner than that unless the delay element is modified. All one needs to use them effectively is a place of concealment within about 100 yards of the target. We have fired from the back seat of a moving auto, from the restroom window of an adjacent building, and at night, from a patch of shrubbery in a small park across the street from the target building. With luck, one can hit a window and get an explosion inside an office or a corridor. But even when the grenade bounces off an outside wall, the explosion shatters windows and the shrapnel keeps people jumping. If we keep it up long enough, we can probably force the government to shutter all the windows in federal buildings, which will certainly help raise the consciousness of federal workers. But it's clear that we can't maintain this type of activity indefinitely. We lost one of our best activists yesterday, Roger Green from Unit 8. And we are bound to lose more as time passes. The system must inevitably win any war of attrition, considering the numerical advantage they have over us. We've talked this problem over among ourselves many times, and we always come back to the same stumbling block. A revolutionary attitude is virtually non-existent in America outside the organization, and all our activities to date don't seem to have changed this fact. The masses of people certainly aren't in love with the system. In fact, their grumbling has increased steadily over the past 6 or 7 years as living conditions have deteriorated. But they are still far too comfortable and complacent to entertain the idea of revolt. On top of this is the enormous disadvantage we suffer from having the system controlling the image of us which reaches the public. We receive a continuous feedback from our legals on what the public is thinking, and most people have accepted without hesitation the system's portrayal of us as gangsters and murderers. Without some sort of empathy between us and the general public, we can never find enough new recruits to make up for our losses. And with the system controlling virtually every channel of communications with the public, it's hard to see how we're going to develop that empathy. Our leaflets and the occasional seizure of a broadcasting station for a few minutes just can't make much headway against the non-stop torrent of brainwashing the system uses for keeping the people in line. The lights have just come on again, now that I'm ready to hit the sack. Sometimes I think the system's own weaknesses will bring about its downfall just as quickly without our help as with it. The incessant power failures are only one crack among thousands in this crumbling edifice we are trying so desperately to pull down. The next diary entry is dated November 8th. The last few days have seen a major change in our domestic affairs. The population in our shop increased to 8 last Thursday, and now it's down to 4 again. Myself, Catherine, and Bill and Carol Hanrahan, formerly of Unit 6. Henry and George have teamed up with Edna Carlson, who also came to us after Unit 6 disaster, and with Dick Wheeler, the only survivor of a police raid on Unit 11's hideout Thursday. The four of them have moved to a new location in the district. The new arrangement has us better divided along functional lines than before, as well as solving the personal problem which had been worrying Catherine and me. We here in the shop are now essentially a technical services unit, while the four who left are a sabotage and assassination unit. Bill Hanrahan is a machinist, a mechanic, and a printer. Until 2 months ago, he and Carol operated a printing press in Alexandria. His wife doesn't share his mechanical genius, but she is a reasonably competent printer. As soon as we get another press set up here, her job will be to produce many of the leaflets and other propaganda materials which the organization clandestinely distributes in this area. I will continue to be responsible for the organization's communications equipment and for specialized ordnance. Bill will assist me with the latter and will also be our gunsmith and armory keeper. Catherine will have a chance to exercise her editorial skills again to a limited extent, and that she will have the responsibility for transforming the typewritten propaganda we receive from Washington Field Command into camera-ready headlines and text for Carol. She will be able to use her own discretion in making condensations, deletions, and other changes necessary for copy fitting. Bill and I finished our first special ordnance job together yesterday. We modified a 4.2-inch mortar to handle 81-millimeter projectiles. The modification was necessary because we have so far been unable to pick up an 81-millimeter mortar for the projectiles which we grabbed in the raid on Aberdeen Proving Ground last month. One of our gun buff members, however, had a serviceable 4.2-inch mortar which he had kept hidden away since the late 1940s. The organization is planning a very important mission in the next day or two, in which the mortar will be used, and Bill and I were under pressure to finish the job on time. Our main difficulty was in finding a piece of steel tube of the right inside diameter to weld inside the 4.2-inch tube, since we have no lathe or other machine tools at this time. Once we found a supplier for the tube, the rest was fairly easy, and we are proud of the result, although it weighs more than 3 times as much as an 81-millimeter mortar should. Today, we did a job which was simple enough in theory, but which gave us more trouble in practice than we had anticipated. Melting the explosive filler out of a 500-pound bomb casing. With a great deal of straining and swearing, and with several good burns from the boiling water we managed to splash all over ourselves, we got most of the tritanol explosive from the bomb into a variety of empty grapefruit juice cans, peanut butter jars, and other containers. The work took all day and exhausted everyone's patience, but now we have the makings for enough medium-sized bombs to last for months. I think that I will find Bill Hanrahan a congenial comrade in arms for carrying out our unit's new duties for the organization. We are now designated Unit 6, and I am in charge. Certainly, the new living arrangement here is more congenial for Catherine and me, now that we are sharing our building with another married couple instead of with two bachelors. I just wrote another married couple. But of course, that was a slip of the pen, since Catherine and I are not formally married. In the last 2 months, and particularly in the last 2 or 3 weeks, however, we have experienced so much together and become so dependent on one another for companionship that a bond at least as strong as that of marriage has developed between us. In the past, whenever one of us had an organizational assignment to carry out, we usually contrived to work together on it. Now such collaboration will not require any contrivance. It's interesting that the organization, which has imposed on all of us a life which is unnatural in many respects, has led to a more natural relationship between the sexes inside the organization than exists outside. Although unmarried female members are theoretically equal to male members in that they are subject to the same discipline, our women are actually cherished and protected to a much larger degree than women in the general society are. Consider rape, for example, which has become such an omnipresent pestilence these days. It had already been increasing at a rate of 20% to 25% per year since the early 1970s until last year, when the Supreme Court ruled that all laws making rape a crime are unconstitutional because they presume a legal difference between the sexes. Rape, the judges ruled, can only be prosecuted under the statutes covering non-sexual assaults. In other words, rape has been reduced to the status of a punch in the nose. In cases where no physical injury can be proved, it is now virtually impossible to obtain a prosecution or even an arrest. The result of this judicial mischief has been that the incidence of rape has zoomed to the point that the legal statisticians have recently estimated that 1 out of every 2 American women can expect to be raped at least once in her lifetime. In many of our big cities, of course, the statistics are much worse. The women's lib groups have greeted this development with dismay. It isn't exactly what they had in mind when they began agitating for equality 2 decades ago. At least there's dismay among the rank and file of such groups. I have a suspicion that their leaders, most of whom are Jewesses, had this outcome in mind from the beginning. Black civil rights spokesmen, on the other hand, have had only praise for the Supreme Court's decision. Rape laws, they said, are racist because a disproportionately large number of blacks have been charged under them. Nowadays, gangs of black thugs hang around parking lots and school playgrounds and roam the corridors of office buildings and apartment complexes, looking for any attractive, unescorted white girl, and knowing that punishment, either from the disarmed citizenry or the handcuffed police, is extremely unlikely. Gang rapes in school classrooms have become an especially popular new sport. Some particularly liberal women may find that this situation provides a certain amount of satisfaction for their masochism, a way of atoning for their feelings of racial guilt. But for normal white women, it is a daily nightmare. One of the sickest aspects of the whole thing is that many young whites, instead of opposing this new threat to their race, have apparently decided to join it. White rapists have become more common, and there have even been instances of integrated rape gangs recently. Nor have the girls remained entirely passive. Sexual debauchery of every sort on the part of young white men and women, and even children in their preteens, has reached a level which would have been unimaginable only 2 or 3 years ago. The queers, the fetishists, the mixed-race couples, the sadists, and the exhibitionists, urged on by the mass media, are parading their perversions in public, and the public is joining them. Just last week, when Catherine and I went into the district to pick up the salaries for our unit, which finally came through when we were down nearly to our last can of soup, there was a nasty little incident. While we were waiting at the bus stop for a homeward-bound bus, I decided to run into a drugstore a few feet away to buy a newspaper. I was gone for no more than 20 seconds, but when I came back, a greasy-looking youth, approximately white, but with an afro hairstyle popular among young degenerates, was taunting Catherine with obscenities while dancing and weaving around her like a boxer. Here is inserted one of the editorial notes to the reader. Afro refers to the Negro or African race, which, until its sudden disappearance during the Great Revolution, exerted an increasingly degenerative influence on the culture and lifestyles of the inhabitants of North America. I grabbed him by the shoulder, spun him around, and hit him in the face as hard as I could. As he went down, I had the deep, primitive satisfaction of seeing four or five of his teeth come washing out of his shattered mouth on a copious flow of dark red blood. I reached into my pocket for my pistol, fully intending to kill him on the spot, but Catherine seized my arm and caution returned. Instead of shooting him, I straddled him and directed three kicks at his groin with all my strength. He jerked convulsively and emitted a short, choking scream with the first kick, and then he lay still. Passers-by averted their eyes and hurried on. Across the street, two blacks gawked and hooted. Catherine and I hurried around the corner. We walked about six blocks, then doubled back and caught the bus at another stop. Catherine told me later that the youth had run up to her as soon as I had entered the drugstore. He had put his arm around her, propositioned her, and started pawing her breasts. She is fairly strong and agile, and she was able to jerk away from him, but he blocked her from following me into the drugstore. As a rule, Catherine carries a pistol, but the day was unseasonably warm, unsuited for a coat, and she wore clothes which left no room for concealing a firearm. Since she was with me, she hadn't even bothered to carry one of the tear gas canisters, which have become essential articles of dress for women these days. In that regard, it is interesting to note that the same people who agitated so hysterically for gun confiscation before the Coin Act are now calling for tear gas to be outlawed too. There have even been cases recently where women who used their tear gas to fend off would-be rapists have been charged with armed assault. The world has become so crazy that nothing really comes as a surprise anymore. In contrast to the situation outside, rape inside the organization is almost unthinkable. But there is no doubt at all in my mind that if a genuine case of forcible rape did occur, the perpetrator would be rewarded with 8 grams of lead within a matter of hours. When we got back to the shop, Henry and another man were waiting for us. Henry wanted me to give him a final rundown on the sight settings for the mortar we had modified. When they left, they took the mortar with them. I still don't know what they will use it for. Catherine and I are both very fond of Henry, and we will miss his presence in our new unit. He's the kind of person on whom the success of the organization will ultimately depend. Catherine had already taught Henry most of her tricks of makeup and disguise, and when he left with the mortar, she gave him the greater part of her supply of wigs, beards, plastic gizmos, and cosmetics. The next diary entry is dated November 9th, 1991. What a day! At 2 o'clock this afternoon, an extraordinary session of the Congress convened to hear an address by the President. He was to ask for special legislation which would allow the government to stamp out racism and combat terrorism more effectively. One thing he intended to ask the Congress for, according to the press, was the long-expected internal passport law. Despite our destruction last month of the computer to be used with this passport program, the government is obviously pressing ahead with it. The Capitol had been surrounded by somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 secret policemen and armed, uniformed soldiers. Jeeps with mounted machine guns were everywhere. There were even 2 tanks and several armored personnel carriers. Members of the press and congressional staffers had to pass through three separate rings of barricades and barbed wire, at each of which they were thoroughly searched for weapons in order to approach the Capitol. Helicopters whirred overhead. No band of guerrillas bent on sabotage or assassination could have gotten within two blocks of the place, even in a suicide dash. In fact, the government obviously overdid the security arrangements just to heighten the sense of urgency of the occasion. The spectacle of all the troops and guns around the Capitol left no doubt in the minds of the TV viewers, I'm sure, that there is an emergency situation in the country which calls for the strongest possible measures from the government. Then, as the TV cameras were preparing to switch from the crowded scene outside the Capitol to the speaker's podium in the House chamber, where the president would be speaking, a mortar round, although no one realized that's what it was, exploded about 200 yards northwest of the building. TV watchers heard the explosion but couldn't see anything except an indistinct puff of gray smoke floating over the Capitol. For the next few seconds, there was general confusion. Soldiers with gas masks on were scurrying in one direction, while grim-faced secret policemen with drawn pistols were running in the other direction. The TV commentator announced breathlessly that someone had set off a bomb in one of the Capitol parking lots. He babbled on for a little less than a minute, speculating as to who had done it, how they had managed to get the bomb past the security forces, how many persons had been hurt by the blast, and so on. Then the second round landed. This one went off with a bang and a flash about 50 yards in front of the TV camera. It made almost a direct hit on a squad of soldiers manning a machine gun behind a heap of sandbags in the Capitol's east parking lot. "It's our mortar," I shouted. It must have also dawned simultaneously on every man with military experience watching the scene that a mortar was responsible for the two explosions. Mortars are marvelous little weapons, especially for guerrilla warfare. They drop their deadly rounds silently and almost vertically onto their target. They can be fired from total cover, and persons in the target area cannot tell from which direction the projectiles are coming. In this case, I guessed immediately that our people were firing from a secluded, densely wooded area on the west bank of the Potomac, just over 2 miles from the Capitol. Henry and I had checked the area out some time ago for just such a purpose, because every important federal building in Washington is within 81-millimeter mortar range of it. About 45 seconds after the second round, the third one landed on the roof of the south wing of the Capitol and exploded inside the building. They had the range now, and the projectiles began raining down at 4 to 5 second intervals. Practically everyone, including most of the TV crews, had scrambled for cover, but one intrepid cameraman remained at his post. We saw beautiful blossoms of flame and steel sprouting everywhere, dancing across the asphalt, thundering in the midst of splintered masonry and burning vehicles, erupting now inside and now outside the Capitol, wreaking their bloody toll in the ranks of tyranny and treason. It was all over in about 3 minutes, but while it lasted, it was the most magnificent spectacle I have ever seen. What an impression it must have made on the general public watching it on TV. And there was more excitement today, both in California and New York. The Los Angeles City Council was convened for the sake of watching a telecast of the president's address to Congress before voting on several anti-racist ordinances of their own. Just about the time the fireworks started here, four of our men, using phony police identification, walked into the council meeting there and began throwing grenades. Eight council members were killed outright, and our men made a clean getaway. An hour earlier in New York, the organization used a bazooka to shoot down an airliner which had just taken off for Tel Aviv with a load of vacationing dignitaries, mostly Jews. There were no survivors. At this point, an editorial note to the reader is inserted. A bazooka was a portable launcher for small rockets, used primarily as an infantry weapon against armored vehicles during World War II, in the years 60 to 54 before the new era, and already obsolete by 8 BNE. Tel Aviv was the largest city in Palestine during the period of Jewish occupation of that unfortunate country in the old era. The ruins of the city are still too radioactive for human habitation. And now back to the text. All in all, it has been a busy day for the organization. I'm greatly invigorated by these demonstrations of our capability for launching multiple simultaneous strikes against the system, and I'm sure that the same is true of all our comrades. Despite all the noise and smoke and wreckage caused by our attack on the Capitol, only 61 persons were killed, we learned from later news reports. Among these are two congressmen, one sub-cabinet official, and four or five senior congressional staffers. But the real value of all our attacks today lies in the psychological impact, not in the immediate casualties. For one thing, our efforts against the system gained immeasurably in credibility. More important, though, is what we taught the politicians and the bureaucrats. They learned this afternoon that not one of them is beyond our reach. They can huddle behind barbed wire and tanks in the city, or they can hide behind the concrete walls and alarm systems of their country estates, but we can still find them and kill them. All the armed guards and bulletproof limousines in America cannot guarantee their safety. That is a lesson they will not forget. Now they are all raging at us and solemnly promising the public that they will stamp us out. But after they have had a chance to think about it, some of them will be ready to consider buying insurance. The great weakness of the system is its utter moral corruption. They have us vastly outmanned and outgunned, but not one of their leaders is motivated by anything other than self-interest. They are ready to betray the system the instant they can see an advantage in doing so. For now, we mustn't let them know that they are all inevitably headed for the gallows. Let them think that they can make a deal with us and save their necks when the system falls. Only the Jews are under no illusions in this regard. As for the public, it's a little early yet to know what the spectrum of their reactions to today's exploits will be. Most of them, of course, will believe just what they're told to believe. Basically, they want to be left alone with their beer and their television sets. Their mentality is a reflection of the movie fan magazines and the TV sitcoms with which the system keeps them saturated. Here again, a note to the reader. The word sitcom apparently refers to a type of television program popular during the last years of the old era. And now the text again. Nevertheless, we must carefully monitor the public's feelings toward the system and toward us. Although the great majority of them will continue to support the system as long as their refrigerators are kept full, it is from the public that we must draw our recruits in order to make up for our losses. Our present inability to recruit is a source of great worry to everyone. Rumor has it that there has not been a single new recruit in the Washington area in the last 2 months. During that time, we've lost approximately 15% of our strength. I hope conditions aren't as bad elsewhere. Of all the segments of the population from which we had hoped to draw new members, the conservatives and right-wingers have been the biggest disappointment. They are the world's worst conspiracy mongers, and also the world's greatest cowards. In fact, their cowardice is exceeded only by their stupidity. The current conspiracy theory being circulated among conservatives is that the organization is actually in the pay of the system. We are hired provocateurs whose job is to raise enough hell to justify the repressive counter-revolutionary and anti-racist measures the system is taking. If we would just stop rocking the boat, things would be easier on everyone. Whether they believe that theory or not, it gives them an excuse for not joining us. At the other extreme, the knee-jerk liberals have forgotten all about their radical chic enthusiasm of a few years ago, now that we are the radicals. They take their ideological cues from the smart magazines and columnists, and the in thing at the moment is to be solidly pro-system. In their own way, the liberals despite their pretensions to sophistication, are as mindless and as easily manipulated as the conservatives. The Christians are a mixed bag. Some of them are among our most devoted and courageous members. Their hatred of the system is based on, in addition to the reasons the rest of us have, their recognition of the system's role in undermining and perverting Christendom. But all the ones who are still affiliated with major churches are against us. The Jewish takeover of the Christian churches and corruption of the ministry are now virtually complete. The pulpit prostitutes preach the system's party line to their flocks every Sunday, and they collect their 30 pieces of silver in the form of government study grants, brotherhood awards, fees for speaking engagements, and a good press. The libertarians are another group which is divided. About half of them support the system, and half are against it. They're all against us, however. The ones who are against the system just happen to see the system as a bigger threat than the organization. As our credibility grows, more and more libertarians will support the system. There is probably no way we can use this group. No, there is not much hope for making inroads into any of these various ideological segments of the population. If we're able to find new recruits, it will be among those who are presently uncommitted. The system's brainwashing has not bent everyone's mind out of shape. There are still millions and millions of good people out there who neither believe the system's propaganda nor have allowed themselves to be seduced to the animal-like level of existence of so many who live solely for the sake of gratifying their senses. How can we motivate these people to join us? Life is uglier and uglier these days, more and more Jewish, but it is still moderately comfortable, and comfort is the great corrupter, the great maker of cowards. It seems that, for the time being, we have already caught all the real revolutionaries in America in our net. Now we must learn how to make some more, and quickly. The next diary entry is dated November 14th. We had a visit from Henry today, and I learned some of the details of Monday's mortar attack on the Capitol. It had involved only three of our people: Henry and the man who helped him carry the mortar parts and the projectiles to their pre-selected firing spot in the woods and get everything set up, and a girl with a small transmitter in a park a few blocks from the Capitol who served as a spotter. She radioed range corrections to Henry's helper while Henry dropped the projectiles into the tube. The range settings I had calculated had been almost perfect. They used up all the 81mm ammunition which was stolen from Aberdeen last month, and Henry wanted to know whether I could improvise some more. I explained to him the difficulty of the task. Bombs we can make, fairly sophisticated ones too. But mortar projectiles are something else. They are far too complex for our present capabilities. Anything I might be able to improvise would be a very crude approximation to the real thing, with nowhere near the accuracy. We'll just have to raid another armory, with all the risks that entails, before we can use our mortar again. Another thing I talked to Henry about is the rash of relatively minor bombings which have occurred in the last 2 or 3 days. There have been 100 or more of them all around the country, including 4 in Washington, and they have puzzled me in several respects, mainly the choice of targets: banks, department stores, corporation offices, but also their apparent amateurishness. For every bomb which exploded, it seems that the police discovered at least one which fizzled. Henry confirmed my suspicions. The bombings, at least those in this area, are not the work of the organization. That's interesting. We seem to have unintentionally galvanized some of the latent anarchists, or God knows what, who've been lurking in the woodwork. The media, of course, have been attributing everything to us, which is embarrassing in view of the amateurishness. But perhaps the phenomenon itself is not a bad development. At least the secret police will have a lot more to keep them busy, and that will take some of the pressure off us. The growth of nihilism, which the system has encouraged for so long, may now be paying off for us instead of for the system. Today I had a rather interesting experience myself in this regard. I had to go into Georgetown to take care of a minor communications problem for Unit 4. Georgetown, once the most stylish area of Washington, has succumbed in the last 5 years to the same plague which has turned the rest of the nation's capital into an asphalt jungle. Most of the high-priced shops have given way to gay bars, massage parlors, porn stalls, liquor stores, and similar capitalist ventures. Garbage litters the sidewalks, and blacks, who used to be pretty scarce there, are swarming all over. But there are still many whites living in Georgetown, after a fashion. The once fashionable townhouses have their windows boarded up now, but many are occupied by colonies of squatters, mostly young dropouts and runaways. They lead a marginal, brutal existence, begging for handouts in the streets, rummaging through trash bins for leftovers, occasionally stealing. Some of the girls engage in casual prostitution. Virtually all of them, or so I thought until today, keep themselves in a permanently drugged condition. Since the system stopped enforcing the drug laws last year, heroin has been about as cheap and easy to get as cigarettes. The cops generally leave them alone, although some of the stories about what goes on among these kids are horrifying. Inside their strongholds, the boarded-up buildings in which they cook and eat and sleep and make love and give birth and pump dope into their veins and die, they seem to have reverted to a pre-civilized lifestyle. Kooky religious cults involving lots of incense and incantations flourish among them. Various brands of Satan worship, reminiscent of the ancient Semitic cults, are especially prevalent. Ritual torture and ritual murder are rumored to take place, as well as ritual cannibalism, ritual sex orgies, and other non-Western practices. I had finished my chore for Unit 4, which, having some of our more bohemian members, blends more unobtrusively into the Georgetown scene than any of our other units could, and was headed back to the bus stop when I came across an all-too-familiar incident. Two young thugs, they looked like Puerto Ricans or Mexicans, were struggling on the sidewalk with a red-headed girl trying to pull her into a doorway. A prudent citizen would have passed by without interfering, but I stopped, watched for a moment, and then started toward the struggling trio. The two swarthy males were distracted just enough by my approach to give the girl a chance to break free. They glared at me and shouted a few obscenities, but they didn't try to catch the girl, who quickly put 100 feet or so between herself and her would-be abductors. I turned and went on my way. The girl walked slowly, allowing me to catch up to her. "Thanks," she said, flashing me a warm smile. She was really quite pretty, but very shabbily dressed and no older than 17. Obviously one of Georgetown's street people. I chatted with her as we walked along. One of the first pieces of information I elicited from her was that she had not eaten in 2 days and was very hungry. We stopped at a sidewalk diner, and I bought her a hamburger and a milkshake. After that, she was still hungry, so I bought another hamburger and some French fries for her. While she ate, we talked, and I learned several interesting things. One was that life among the dropouts is more diversified than I had thought. There are colonies which are on drugs, and colonies which strictly abstain from drugs, colonies which are racially mixed, and all-white colonies, sexually balanced colonies, and all-male wolf packs. The groups are also divided along religious cult lines. Elsa, that's her name, said she has never been on drugs. She left the group she was living with 2 days ago, after a domestic dispute, and was in the process of being dragged into the lair of a wolf pack when I happened by. She also gave me some good leads as to who is responsible for the recent bombings, which puzzled Henry and me. It seems to be general knowledge among her friends that several of the Georgetown colonies are, to use her words, into that sort of thing, you know, trashing the pigs. Elsa herself seems to be completely apolitical and not concerned one way or another about the bombings. I didn't want to pry too much and make her think I was a cop, so I didn't push her for more information on the subject. Under the circumstances, I really couldn't afford to bring Elsa back to our headquarters with me, but I still had to fight the temptation. I slipped her a $5 bill when we parted, and she assured me that she would find a place for herself in one of the groups without difficulty. Probably she would go back to the group she had left. She gave me their address so I could look her up. Thinking it over this evening, it seems to me that we may be overlooking some potentially useful allies among these young dropouts. Individually, they are not very impressive, to be sure. But it may very well be that we can make use of them in a collective way. It bears further consideration. The next diary entry is dated November 16th, 1991. The response of the system to last week's mortar attack is taking shape. For one thing, it's more difficult to move around in public now. Police and troops have greatly stepped up their spot checks, and they're stopping everyone, pedestrians as well as vehicles. There are announcements on the radio about once an hour, warning people that they are subject to summary arrest if they are unable to establish their identity when stopped. The organization has already been able to furnish some of us with forged driver's licenses and other false identification, but it will be some time before everyone in the Washington area has been taken care of. Yesterday, Carol had a close call. She had gone to a supermarket to buy the week's groceries for our unit, and a police patrol arrived while she was in the checkout line. They stationed men at each exit and required everyone leaving the store to show them satisfactory identification. Just as Carol was ready to leave, there was a commotion at one exit. The police had been questioning a man who apparently was carrying no identification, and he became belligerent. When the cops tried to put handcuffs on him, he slugged one of them and tried to run. They tackled him before he had gone more than a few feet, but the cops stationed at the other exits all ran over to help. Carol was able to slip out a temporarily unguarded exit with her groceries. All this identity checking has diverted the police from their regular duties, and the blacks and other criminal elements are really taking advantage of it. Some Army personnel are also participating in the identity checking and other police operations, but their main duty is still guarding government buildings and media facilities. The most interesting development is that the Human Relations Councils have also been given emergency police powers, and they are deputizing large numbers of blacks from the welfare rolls the way they did for the gun raids. In the district and in Alexandria, some of these deputized blacks are already swaggering around and stopping whites on the streets. There are rumors that they are demanding bribes from those they stop, threatening them with arrest if they don't pay. And they've been hauling some white women into their field headquarters for questioning. There they are stripped, gang-raped, and beaten, all in the name of the law. The news media aren't breathing a word about these outrages, of course, but the word is still getting around. People are angry and frightened, but they don't know what to do. Without arms, there is little they can do. They are completely at the mercy of the system. It's hard to figure why the system is deliberately stirring things up by deputizing blacks again after the enormous amount of resentment that caused 2 years ago. We've talked it over among ourselves in the unit, and our opinions are divided. Everyone but me seems to think that the events of last Monday panicked the system and caused them to overreact again. Maybe, but I don't think so. They've had 2 months now to become used to the idea of a guerrilla war between them and us. And it's been nearly 5 weeks since we really bloodied their noses for the first time by blowing up the FBI building. They know that our underground strength nationwide couldn't be more than 2,000. And they must also know that they are wearing us down. I think they are unleashing the blacks on the whites strictly as a preventive measure. By terrifying the white population, they will make it more difficult for us to recruit, thus speeding our demise. Bill argues to the contrary, that the white reaction to the renewed activities of the Human Relations Councils and their gangs of deputies will make recruiting easier for us. To a certain extent, that was true in 1989. But white Americans have become so acclimatized to the growing openness of the system's tyranny in the last 2 years that I believe the latest move will serve more to intimidate than to arouse them. We'll see. Meanwhile, there's a mountain of work waiting for me. Washington Field Command has requested that I furnish them with 30 new transmitters and 100 new receivers before the end of the year. I don't know how I can do it, but I'd better get started. The next diary entry is dated November 27. Until today, I've been working my tail off, day and night, trying to get the communications equipment built that Washington Field Command wants. 3 days ago, Tuesday, I rounded up the last of the components needed and set up an assembly line here in the shop, pressing Carol and Catherine into service. By having them perform some of the simpler operations in the assembly process, I may be able to meet my deadline after all. Yesterday, however, I received a summons from Washington Field Command, which kept me away from the shop from early this morning until 10 o'clock tonight. One of the purposes of the summons was a loyalty check. I didn't know that before I reached the address I had been given, however. It was the little gift shop in which Harry Powell's trial took place. A guard ushered me into a small office off the basement storeroom. Two men were waiting for me there. One was the Major Williams from Revolutionary Command, whom I met earlier. The other was a Dr. Clark, one of our legals, and, as I soon learned, a clinical psychologist. Williams explained to me that the organization has developed a testing process for new underground recruits. Its function is to determine the recruits' true motivations and attitudes, and to screen out those sent to us as infiltrators by the secret police, as well as those deemed unfit for other reasons. In addition to new recruits, however, a number of veteran members of the organization are also being tested, namely those whose duties have given them access to information which would be of special value to the secret police. My detailed knowledge of our communications system alone would put me in that category, and my work has also brought me into contact with an unusually large number of our members in other units. We originally planned that no member in an underground unit would know the identity being used by or the unit location of any member outside his own unit. In practice, though, we've badly compromised that plan. The way things have developed in the last 2 months, there are now several of us in the Washington area who could betray, either voluntarily or through torture, a large number of other members. We exercised great care in the recruiting and evaluation of new members after the gun raids, of course, but nothing like what I was subjected to this morning. There were injections of some drug, at least two, but I was in a fog after the first one and can't be sure how many more there were. And half a dozen electrodes were attached to various parts of my body. A bright, pulsing light filled my eyes, and I lost all contact with my surroundings, except through the voices of my interrogators. The next thing I remember is yawning and stretching as I woke up on a cot in the basement nearly 3 hours later, although I was told that the interrogation itself lasted less than half an hour. I felt refreshed, with no apparent after effects of whatever drug I was given. The guard came over to me as I stood up. I could hear muffled voices from the closed office. Someone else was being interrogated, and I saw another man sleeping on a cot a few feet from mine. I suspect he had recently gone through the same process I had. I was led into another basement room, a tiny cubicle containing only a chair and a small metal table, actually a typewriter stand. On the table was a black plastic binder, perhaps 2 inches thick, of the sort in which typewritten reports are bound. The guard told me that I was to read everything in the binder very carefully, and that Major Williams would then talk to me again. He pulled the door closed as he went out. I had barely sat down when a girl brought me a plate of sandwiches and a mug of hot coffee. I thanked the girl, and as I was hungry, I began sipping the coffee and munching a sandwich while I casually read the first page of the material in the binder. When I finished the last page some 4 hours later, I noticed that the sandwiches, including an uneaten portion of the one I had started, were still on the plate. The mug was nearly full of thoroughly cold coffee. It was as if I had just returned to Earth, to the room, after a 1,000-year voyage through space. What I had read, it amounted to a book of about 400 typed pages, had lifted me out of this world, out of my day-to-day existence as an underground fighter for the organization, and it had taken me to the top of a high mountain from which I could see the whole world with all its nations and tribes and races spread out before me. And I could see the ages spread out before me too, from the steaming primordial swamps of 100 million years ago to the unlimited possibilities which the centuries and the millennia ahead hold for us. The book placed our present struggle, the organization and its goals and what is at stake, in a much larger context than I have ever really considered before. That is, I had thought about many of the things in the book before, but I had never put them all together into a single coherent pattern. I had never seen the whole picture so clearly. At this point, there's another editorial note to the reader. It is obvious that Turner is referring to the book. We know from other evidence that it was written approximately 10 years before the Record of Martyrs in which it is mentioned. That is, probably sometime in the year 9 before the new era, or 1990 according to the old chronology. Turner mentions typed pages, but it is not clear whether he means reproductions of typewritten pages or the originals themselves. If the latter is the case, then we may have here the only extant reference to the original copy of the book. Several reproductions of the original typescript in binders fitting Turner's description have survived and are preserved in the archives, but archaeologists still have found no trace of the original. Now back to the text. For the first time, I understand the deepest meaning of what we are doing. I understand now why we cannot fail, no matter what we must do to win, and no matter how many of us must perish in doing it. Everything that has been and everything that is yet to be depend on us. We are truly the instruments of God in the fulfillment of His grand design. These may seem like strange words to be coming from me, who has never been religious, but they are utterly sincere words. I was still sitting there thinking about what I had read when Major Williams opened the door. He started to ask me to go with him when he noticed that I hadn't finished my sandwiches. He brought another chair into the tiny room and invited me to finish eating while we talked. I learned several very interesting things during our brief conversation. One is that, contrary to my earlier belief, the organization is getting a steady trickle of new recruits. None of us had realized it because Washington Field Command has been putting the new people into brand new units. That's why the new communications equipment is needed. Another thing I found out is that a significant fraction of the new recruits have been secret police spies. Fortunately, the organization's leadership foresaw this threat and devised a remedy in time. They realized that, once we went underground, the only way we could safely continue recruiting would be to screen new people in a foolproof way. Here's the way it works. When our legals have someone who says he wants to join the organization, he is turned over immediately to Dr. Clark. Dr. Clark's method of interrogation leaves no room for evasion or deceit. As Major Williams explained it, if the candidate flunks the test, he never wakes up from his little nap afterward. That way, the system can never find out why their spies are disappearing. So far, he said, we have caught more than 30 would-be infiltrators, including several women. I shuddered to think what would have happened if my own interrogation had revealed me to be too unstable or lacking in loyalty to be trusted with what I know. And I felt a momentary flash of resentment that Dr. Clark, who is not even an underground member, should have held the decision of life or death for me in his hands. The resentment quickly passed, however, when I considered that there is really no stigma to being illegal. The only reason Dr. Clark is not in the underground is that his name was not on the FBI's arrest list in September. Our illegals play just as vital a role in our struggle as do those of us underground. They are vital to our propaganda and recruiting effort, our only close contact with the world outside the organization, and they run even more of a risk of being found out and arrested than we do. Major Williams must have sensed my thoughts, because he put his hand on my shoulder, smiled, and assured me that my test had gone very well. So well, in fact, that I was to be initiated into a select inner structure within the organization. Reading the book I had just finished was the first step in that initiation. The next step took place about an hour later. Six of us were gathered in a loose semicircle in the shop upstairs. It was after business hours, and the blinds were tightly drawn. The only light came from two large candles toward the back of the shop. I was the next to the last to enter the room. At the top of the stairs, the same girl who had brought my sandwiches stopped me and handed me a robe of some coarse gray material with a hood attached, something like a monk's robe. After I had put on the robe, she showed me where to stand and cautioned me to be silent. Their features shadowed by their hoods, I could not make out the faces of any of my companions in that strange little gathering. As the sixth participant reached the doorway at the top of the stairs, however, I turned and was startled to glimpse a tall, burly man in the uniform of a sergeant in the District of Columbia Metropolitan Police slipping into a robe. Finally, from another door at the back, Major Williams entered. He also wore one of the gray robes, but his hood was thrown back so that the two candles, one on either side, illuminated his face. He spoke to us in a quiet voice, explaining that each of us who had been selected for membership in the order had passed the test of the word and the test of the deed. That is, we have all proved ourselves, not only through a correct attitude toward the cause, but also through our acts in the struggle for the realization of the cause. As members of the order, we are to be the bearers of the faith. Only from our ranks will the future leaders of the organization come. He told us many other things, too, reiterating some of the ideas I had just read. The order, he explained, will remain secret, even within the organization, until the successful completion of the first phase of our task, the destruction of the system. And he showed us the sign by which we might recognize one another. And then we swore the oath, a mighty oath, a moving oath, that shook me to my bones and raised the hair on the back of my neck. As we filed out one by one, at intervals of about a minute, the girl at the door took our robes, and Major Williams placed a gold chain with a small pendant around each of our necks. He had already told us about these. Inside each pendant is a tiny glass capsule. We are to wear them at all times, day and night. Whenever danger is especially imminent, and we might be captured, we are to remove the capsules from the pendants and carry them in our mouths. And if we are captured and can see no hope of immediate escape, we are to break the capsules with our teeth. Death will be painless and almost instantaneous. Now our lives truly belong only to the order. Today I was, in a sense, born again. I know now that I will never again be able to look at the world or the people around me, or my own life, in quite the same way I did before. When I undressed for bed last night, Catherine immediately spotted my new pendant and asked about it, of course. She also wanted to know what I had been doing all day. Fortunately, Catherine is the sort of girl with whom one can be completely truthful, a rare jewel indeed. I explained to her the function of the pendant and told her that it is necessary because of a new task I am undertaking for the organization, a task whose details I have obliged myself to tell no one, at least for the present. She was obviously curious, but she didn't press me further. Earl Turner's next entry is dated November 28, 1991. A disturbing thing happened tonight, which could have had fatal consequences for all of us. A carload of young junkies tried to break into the building here, evidently thinking it was deserted, and we had to dispose of all of them and their car. This is the first time something like this has happened, but the abandoned appearance of this place may invite more trouble of the same sort in the future. We were all upstairs eating when the car pulled into our parking area and triggered our perimeter alarm. Bill and I went into the darkened garage downstairs and uncovered a peephole so that we could see who was outside. The car had cut off its lights, and one occupant had gotten out and was trying our door. He then began pulling loose the boards which were nailed over the glass in the door. Another youth got out and came over to help him. We couldn't see their features in the darkness, but we could hear them talking. They were obviously Negroes, and they obviously intended to get into the place one way or another. Bill tried to discourage them. In his best imitation ghetto accent, he shouted through the door, "Hey, man! This place occupied. Move your ass on out of here." The two blacks jumped back from the door, startled. They began whispering to one another, and two other figures from the car joined them. Then a dialogue began between Bill and one of the blacks. It went about like this. "We didn't know anybody was here, brother. We just looking for a place to shoot up." "Well, now you knows, so get." "Why you so hostile, brother? Let us in. We got some stuff and some chicks. You by yourself?" "No, I ain't by myself, and I don't want no stuff. You just better move on, man." At this point, there's inserted another editorial note to the reader. The dialect of the Negroes in America contained many special terms relating to drug usage, which was endemic among them up to the end. Stuff meant heroin, an opium derivative which was especially popular. To shoot up was to inject the heroin into a vein. Both the Negro's drug habits and much of his dialect spread to the white population of America during the period of government-enforced racial mixing in the last five decades of the old era. Now we return to Earl Turner's text. But Bill was unsuccessful in his attempt to discourage them. The second black began a rhythmic pounding on the garage door, chanting over and over, "Open up, brother, open up!" Someone in the car turned on a radio, and Negro music began blaring at a deafening volume. Since the last thing we could afford was to attract the attention of the police or of someone at the trucking firm next door with a continuation of this noisy scene, Bill and I quickly made a plan. We armed both the girls with shotguns and posted them behind crates to one side of the shop area. I took a pistol, slipped out the rear door, and silently crept around the side of the building so that I could cover the intruders from the outside. Then Bill announced, "All right, all right. I opened the door, man. You drive your car right in." While Bill began raising the garage door, one of the blacks went back to the car and started the engine. Bill stood to one side and kept his head lowered so that when the car's lights hit him, his white skin was not conspicuous. When everyone was inside, he began lowering the door again. The black's car had not pulled in far enough for the door to close completely, however, and the driver ignored his command to move ahead another foot. Then one of the blacks on foot got a better look at Bill and immediately raised the alarm. "This ain't no brother," he cried. Bill flipped on the shop lights, and the girls came out from their places of concealment as I slipped in under the partly closed door. "Everyone out of the car and flat on the floor," Bill ordered, yanking open the door on the driver's side. "Come on, niggers, move." They looked at the four guns trained on them, and then they moved, although not without loud protest. Two of them, however, were not Negroes. When they were all stretched out on the concrete floor face down, all six of them, we saw that we had three black males, one black female, and two white sluts. I shook my head in disgust at the sight of the two white girls, neither of whom appeared to be over 18. It didn't take long to decide what to do. We couldn't afford the noise of gunshots, so I took a heavy crowbar and Bill picked up a shovel. We started at opposite ends of the crew on the floor, while the girls kept them covered with their shotguns. We worked quickly but precisely, one blow to the back of the head sufficing for each of them. Until the last two, that is. The blade of Bill's shovel glanced off the skull of one of the black males and struck the shoulder of the white girl beside him, cutting into her flesh but not inflicting a lethal wound. Before I could bring my crowbar into play to finish her off, the little bitch was up like a shot. I had pushed the garage door down as far as I could after coming in, but it still hadn't latched properly and had meanwhile crept up about 6 inches. She scooted through this narrow opening and headed for the street, with me about 10 yards behind her. I froze with horror as I saw an arc of light swing along the dark pavement just in front of the running girl. A large truck was turning into the street from the parking lot next door. If the girl reached the street, she would be illuminated by the truck's headlights, and the driver could not fail to see her. Without hesitation, I raised my pistol and fired, instantly dropping the girl in her tracks beside the weed-overgrown fence separating our parking area from that of the trucking firm. It was a very lucky shot, not only in its effect, but also in that the roar from the engine of the accelerating truck effectively masked the report. I crouched in the driveway, drenched in a cold sweat, until the truck had thundered off into the distance. Bill and I loaded the six corpses into the back of the black's car. He drove it off, with Carol following him in our vehicle, and left the grisly cargo parked outside a black restaurant in downtown Alexandria. Let the police figure it out. The work on the new communications equipment is coming along quite well. The girls put so many units together before supper today, and the unfortunate events of the evening, that I couldn't keep up with the tuning and testing, which is my part of the work. If I had a better oscilloscope and a few other instruments, I could do more. The next diary entry is dated November 30th. In thinking over Saturday's events, what surprises me is that I feel no remorse or regret for killing those two white whores. 6 months ago, I couldn't imagine myself calmly butchering a teenaged white girl, no matter what she had done. But I've become much more realistic about life recently. I understand that the two girls were with the blacks only because they had been infected with the disease of liberalism by the schools and the churches and the plastic pop culture that the system churns out for young people these days. Presumably, if they had been raised in a healthy society, they would have had some racial pride. But such considerations are irrelevant to the present phase of our struggle. Until we have in our hands the means for bringing about a general cure for the disease, we must deal with it by other means, just as one must ruthlessly weed out and dispose of diseased animals in any flock, unless one wants to lose the whole flock. This is no time for womanly hand-wringing.